Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. In a moment, we'll be discussing Donald Trump's latest top-level nominations for his incoming administration. They provoked a bit of a gasp, even among some of his allies. They would certainly shake things up if they are approved by the Senate. But what chance the Senate will approve them? Also, in 20 minutes, we'll be taking you to a remote part of the Pacific Ocean where one diver made a very exciting discovery.
So I came up from the first free dive, excited and shouting to the dive boat, "Hey, come here, get the position," and call to my dive buddy, that is my son.
It is a fantastic story, and as promised, in 20 minutes. We're beginning the programme, though, with what, by common consent, are some of the grabbiest nominations yet by Donald Trump for his new administration. For Attorney General, the top law officer in the land, the head of the Department of Justice, Mr. Trump has tapped the fiery Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz for Director of National Intelligence, the person to oversee the US's 18 intelligence agencies. Donald Trump has picked Tulsi Gabbard, the former Democratic Congresswoman who for years has espoused views on points of foreign policy that have strongly cut against the grain of conventional US foreign policy. We'll get into those later in the programme. Let's begin, though, with Matt Gaetz, the now former congressman, as he's just resigned his seat in order to prepare to take up the new position of Attorney General. To give you a flavour of his strong rhetoric, here's Mr. Gaetz talking a couple of years ago about the issue of abortion.
Our America is a pro-life nation, proudly. Have you watched these pro-abortion, pro-murder rallies? The people are just disgusting. Why is it that the women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions? Nobody wants to impregnate you if you look like a thumb.
Matt Gaetz, a couple of years ago. Let's speak to the BBC's Jess Parker. She's in West Palm Beach, Florida, where Donald Trump is making many of his nominations from. Now, Jess, before we get into Matt Gaetz, you better remind us just how important a position the Attorney General is.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the picks, I think, that people have really been looking out for here in West Palm Beach, where Donald Trump is once again holed up in Mar-a-Lago as part of his transition HQ. But the Attorney General, I mean, they head the Department of Justice. They are the country's top prosecutor, represent the US in legal matters, and really crucially as well, give advice and opinions to the president of the United States and other departments, heads of other departments as well. So a really powerful role. And I think a lot of people, one of the reasons a lot of people have been looking at who might get this job is during the campaign and the last few years, Donald Trump has talked about the enemy from within, revenge or retribution. And there's been a lot of speculation about whether he could, once in power, go after his political opponents. And of course, as well, he's also talked about pardoning some of the January 6th Capitol Hill rioters. So whoever takes Attorney General could potentially have a significant role in those areas. And I think if people thought or were looking to see if the AG appointment might be a person that might temper some of those kinds of plans and some of that rhetoric. I mean, you've just been playing a clip there of Matt Gaetz. I think some people will be thinking again.
Yeah, and he is a man of very strong, forthright right-wing views, but he's also a man who himself has had a brush with investigations by law enforcement agents and also just recently with the House of Representatives Ethics Committee. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so there's been an ongoing ethics committee inquiry into Matt Gaetz. I've actually kind of got the press release that was released earlier this year about that, where they say it's initiated a review into allegations that Representative Matt Gaetz may have engaged in sexual misconduct, illicit drug use, shared inappropriate images on the House floor, and it goes on as well to talk about alleged financial impropriety as well. I mean, Mr. Gaetz has denied wrongdoing in these matters, and it's quite interesting. The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has said that the House Ethics Committee will have no further jurisdiction essentially over Mr. Gaetz, who is resigning his position in order to try and take up that of Attorney General. And I say try, because it's not quite a done deal yet.
And just very briefly, explain why that is.
Well, the Senate is supposed to sign these positions off, and I think a lot of people are saying Mr. Gaetz could face a difficult process, unless, of course, and Donald Trump has talked about this, the process is bypassed by something known as recess appointments. It's something that Mr. Trump has floated. Not clear whether that's going to happen, though.
Jess Parker in Florida, thanks ever so much. Well, as Jess was saying, Matt Gaetz may not necessarily have the easiest ride in his confirmation hearing in the Senate. In the lower house, though, the House of Representatives, he has been getting expressions of support. And this is the House Speaker, Mike Johnson.
He's an accomplished attorney. He's very concerned about the lawfare that has been occurring in the Department of Justice under the Biden administration, and the fact that the American people have lost their faith in our institutions of justice because of everything that he's seen. He's a reformer in his mind and heart, and I think that he'll bring a lot to the table on that.
Which was a point picked up by Glenn Grothman, a Republican congressman from Wisconsin, who's been speaking to the BBC.
We all know, and it shows that I think President Trump wants to shake things up. He's seen the worst of the Department of Justice, and I think Matt Gaetz has the personality to not be intimidated by the bureaucracy that's been around there forever and, quite frankly, has not treated President Trump fairly. The Attorney General is not going in there trying cases like a local district attorney in a American county would. He's going in there to administer the agency as a whole, to get rid of the people who he feels are the problem children. I'm looking forward to Matt being there. There are things I want to give him to do that I think perhaps were not handled properly in past administrations. Perhaps they're discriminating against certain sorts of people in there. I look forward to Matt having that job.
Glenn Grothman. We have been trying to speak to other supporters of Mr. Gaetz on Capitol Hill this morning without success. Let's speak, though, to Barbara Comstock. She's a former Republican congresswoman, senior Justice Department official as well. Barbara, good to have you on NewsHour. What's your reaction to that point from Glenn Grothman that, look, you know, Matt Gaetz is appointed to, well, the hope is he will be appointed to shake things up?
Well, listen, Matt Gaetz does not have the character, integrity, judgment, or independence to head up this large law enforcement agency that oversees the FBI, antitrust, the civil division, the criminal division. You know, this is a huge agency. He has no management experience. You know, he's not been a prosecutor or worked as a private attorney in any kind of capacity either. But it's really these character issues where he's wholly and dangerously unqualified. You know, it hasn't even been mentioned that he's had three DUIs. So like Donald Trump, he also has mugshots. So, you know, great thing for kids. Hey, get your mugshots and you too can be leading the world. So, you know, people are saying, hey, this is Trump being Trump. So, of course, if you have Trump as your president, it's not unexpected. You could get somebody like Matt Gaetz as attorney general. But if I had said this a month ago, hey, if you vote for Trump, you'll get Matt Gaetz as attorney general, people would have called that Trump derangement syndrome.
You've made the point that you feel that his character isn't there, that he doesn't have the experience. But the point
this is
about
his own colleagues who say it. Former Speaker McCarthy, who said,
"Well,
you know, listen,
I mean, that's because Matt Gaetz came after Kevin McCarthy. He didn't like what he was doing as Speaker of the House. So you might imagine that Kevin McCarthy has strong things to say about Matt
Kevin
Gaetz.
McCarthy,
but just on the point on the very central point that, you know, people might have been surprised if you'd said that this was President Trump's intention. People have been sort of suggesting that the voters would be shocked about Donald Trump from the get-go. And the point is about Donald Trump in 2024 is he has won a very big Democratic, very clear Democratic mandate, and he now has support in majority support in both houses of Congress. I mean, the point is people know what Donald Trump is about, and Matt Gaetz is his man to affect some of the big changes he wants to happen in the Justice Department. That's democracy, isn't it?
Well, listen, democracy also has the requirement of Senate confirmation, which would tend, as Hamilton said in Federalist 76, would tend to greatly to prevent the appointment of unfit characters. So the Senate does have that obligation. Now, the Senate can roll over instead of advise and consent. They can roll over and be lapdogs. That is their right also. Listen, the House is only by the smallest of margins, and with Matt Gaetz resigning already to avoid having his ethics investigation, which Kevin McCarthy has said the fact that he wouldn't, that the Republican House that was doing that ethics investigation, the fact that Kevin McCarthy wouldn't kill it, he said that's why Matt Gaetz came after him. His own colleagues, you know, you mentioned, talked about him showing those, you know, dirty pictures on the House floor. I mean, this is someone who's going to head up an agency.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't seen the House Ethics Committee report. We may now not see it. So we mustn't damn him for something that we haven't seen. And indeed, as far as the other investigations are concerned as well, the authorities decided not to prosecute.
Right. But when you do a confirmation hearing, you do a whole FBI background check. You bring information like this forward. That report should come forward. Senators of both parties have already said that's something they'd like to see, because that's the kind of information when you go to the FBI and get a background check that you do. Now, Donald Trump has said he wants to bypass any type of vetting in order to put him in, which he does not have a mandate to do that. And I would argue,
well, he hasn't said that in terms. He said that it may be an option.
He said he would like to do that. And I think the Senate, because, yes, they have 53 senators, but they do have three of those senators, sitting senators, did not vote for Donald Trump. Three of them. That gets you down to 50. Several of them, like Mitch McConnell, Mitch McConnell is going to retire. Others may retire.
Right. So, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch to say that three Republican senators did not vote for Donald Trump.
No, they announced they didn't vote for him. Three of those senators, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Todd Young, publicly announced before the election they would not be voting for Donald Trump. Three of them that are there right now.
Right. Understood. Well, listen, Barbara, we'll have to leave it there. Barbara Comstock, former Republican Congresswoman and senior Justice Department official, thank you very much for joining us. Later in the program, we'll be hearing about another one of those striking nominations that Donald Trump has made for a top job, and that's for the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. Also coming up on the programme, why the comedian Jerry Seinfeld is not predicting that the election of Donald Trump is a bad thing for the movie industry.
Humans are not good prognosticators. We're not good predictors of things. We're good worriers. We really know how to anticipate and get anxious. We're great at that. We are not great at really seeing what's coming.
Jerry Seinfeld, being modest on behalf of the movie industry, we'll hear more from him and others in just over 10 minutes. Our headlines this hour: new research shows that the global prevalence of type 2 diabetes has doubled since 1990, with the biggest rises seen in developing countries. And the other headline from the BBC newsroom: Human Rights Watch has accused Israel of the permanent displacement of Palestinians in Gaza, saying this amounts to a war crime. You're with the BBC World Service, and live from London, this is NewsHour with me, Tim Franks. Peak typhoon season in the Philippines is supposed to be July to October, deep into November, and the archipelago is being absolutely battered by a series of storms. The latest, Super Typhoon Usagi, has now prompted the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people on the main island, Luzon. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton, is with me in the NewsHour studio. Celia, Usagi's made landfall now, is that right?
It's made landfall, and it has slowed just a little bit. So about a few hours ago, the authorities were saying that the main island was going to be hit with winds of up to 185 kilometers an hour. The latest reading I just looked at, it's 175 kilometers per hour. But that's still super typhoon category. Anything over 150, it really is a deadly storm hitting the Philippines. They're going to get about 20 centimeters of rain in just a few hours time. So it really is a serious concern.
And lots and lots of people have been evacuated. Is that right?
Lots of people have been evacuated. But we have to put this all into context in that this is the fifth major storm the Philippines has experienced in just 3 weeks. And another storm is on its heels, is going to make landfall on Sunday. So we had the strange situation where lots of people lost power on Monday in a typhoon that hit on Monday. They haven't received power back. So it was very difficult for the authorities to reach them, to make sure that they were getting into safety. Lots of people are still in shelters. 28,000 people were already in shelters because they lost their homes in previous storms. Another 40,000 people are moving into shelters. So the authorities are really stretched right now, and rescuers are saying they're trying to get to everyone. They're imposing mandatory evacuations, but it's a serious concern with all of these overlapping storms. The Philippines just can't get a break at the moment.
And presumably, I mean, this is, although as ever, we cannot attribute exact weather events to climate change. Just the fact that it is, as you say, overlapping storms, the intensity, the fact that it's so late in the season as well. I mean, it seems to be Exhibit A.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the first time on record that so many storms have occurred at the same time in the month of November. So four storms are still swirling around the Philippines as we speak. Two have already made landfall and crossed away, but they're still in the region. Scientists are saying, you know, we're seeing more storms in a smaller span of time. They're forming closer to coastlines, and they're intensifying much more quickly. One mayor in the Philippines has been accusing the authorities of not giving them enough time. But the weather officials are saying, well, we simply didn't know that this was going to morph into a super typhoon until just 12 hours ago. And so they're really scrambling at the moment.
Celia Hatton, our Asia Pacific regional editor, thank you ever so much. Well, we're going to cross the ocean southeast from the Philippines and head to the waters off the Solomon Islands, and a story to make the heart sing. It is the discovery of the world's largest coral. The news comes, of course, as we hear so many stories about the mass die-off of coral around the world, killed by our warming waters. And the man who found this coral completely by accident is Manu San Felix, a marine biologist and camera operator for National Geographic, and he spoke to me from aboard a boat off the Solomon Islands.
We were heading back, and the dive boat driver, he said, oh, here is a wreck. Would you like to take a look? We are not curious about the shipwreck, but what kind of life could be around? So then I jumped in the water, free diving, and I was so lucky that I looked down and I saw, and I realized in the first seconds that it was a single coral head, but huge. And I said, wow, this is something very special. So I free dived down, and I was with a smile, blown away, because for me it's 44 years diving and thousands of dives, and I have never seen something similar.
Did you realize it was a single coral?
Yes, immediately. I am a marine biologist with a camera, and my passion is nature. So I came up from the first free dive excited and shouting to the dive boat, hey, come here, get the position, and call to my dive buddy, that is my son.
And at what point did you begin to actually take measurements and then think to yourself, well, maybe you just knew this is actually probably going to be the biggest coral ever discovered?
Well, I'm a person that I love to dream, so I didn't want to go ahead with that dream, but I came back to the boat excited and tell to the science team that I showed them the photos because we took photos and video, and then everybody become also excited. And I didn't say nothing about the length. I prefer to be calm. No.
Yeah. Well, calm but excited, and I can still hear it in your voice, Manu. Sadly, you do not have your camera with you for this interview. I've seen pictures of it, and it looks amazing. But you tell me what it looks like. Tell our listeners what it looks like.
I have to say that is something beautiful. And I felt immediately, I was thinking, wow, this is here for hundreds of years. So many amazing humans that, as I don't know, Isaac Newton or Madame Curie or Napoleon, this coral was alive. Like when you look to a paint or a cathedral with hundreds of years, then you feel a respect. For me, that's amazing. And also thinking that this is created by a single polyp, that is a very simple organism with the capability in multiplying in millions of other polyps and surviving to all the ocean conditions. So for me, that is admiring. No? So while I'm a biologist, probably a bit poetic, but all that things were coming to me. And also because it's nice to come back with a positive and nice message, especially in these moments that most of the messages that we get from nature are terrible, no?
It is a wonderful discovery, and you're so right that in the context, I think it's almost half of corals in warm waters are under threat. Given that, do you think it's the fact that this coral was at a slightly deeper level than normal? That means that it's been a bit protected? It's a bit cooler for this coral?
The health of this coral head, of this mega coral, is good. And this is a good surprise, because we were finding coral reefs in the same area, not in a good shape with the impact of bleaching, no, of the raise of temperature. I think we have the opportunity to learn a lot about this very old mega coral, because it's storing the information, what I said, of the conditions of the oceans. Well, and now we have also the responsibility, another responsibility of something wonderful to protect.
And that was the marine biologist Manu San Felix, who's got a wonderful achievement now to his name. He described it beautifully, but you can see pictures of it on our website, bbc.com/news. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC. Welcome back to NewsHour. Donald Trump's re-election has, you may not be surprised to hear, prompted a strong reaction from Hollywood, traditionally a Democratic stronghold, with many big names in the film industry expressing dismay. But what impact will Mr. Trump's return to the White House be likely to have on mainstream and independent movie making? Tom Brooke has this report from New York.
Welcome to the Critics' Choice Documentary Awards.
The Critics' Choice Documentary Awards, one of the film world's first post-election gatherings. Hollywood, long a powerful Democratic stronghold, gave the Kamala Harris campaign numerous celebrity endorsements, but all to no avail. At this awards event, big-name industry figures mingled with lesser-known filmmakers. Some were fearful of what a new Trump administration might bring. Among them, filmmaker Zach Stewart Pontier.
It's a scary time. I think a lot of people are feeling paranoid.
There is the view that in the wake of Donald Trump's victory, a form of resistant cinema may emerge. Many think independent documentary making has a newfound importance. Actor Jeremy Piven.
I really believe that it's more important than ever, and to be truthsayers, you know, in the midst of all this junk, and to cut through it, it's a very important way of getting the word out. So I think documentaries are more important than ever.
We're now at the beginning of awards season in the US. Traditionally, these celebratory events have often been used by liberal luminaries as a platform to vent their displeasure at Republican policies and politicians. But what is going to happen now in the wake of the Democrats' defeat?
I will ask Congress to pass a bill establishing that the only genders recognized are male and female, and they are assigned at birth.
Donald Trump's opposition to transgender rights was a major part of his rhetoric in the closing days of the election campaign. Trans people, not often represented on screen, and their supporters are fearful of what might happen to the portrayal of their lives and their stories in movies in a new Trump era. Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Ben Proudfoot.
Yeah, I mean, in light of the election, I think it's more important now than ever for documentary filmmakers to use the power of filmmaking, to use our cameras, to use our platforms, to make sure that stories are told, especially those of the trans community.
But for all the fears of Hollywood liberals over what a new Trump presidency may portend for the film industry, one of the biggest names in American show business, Jerry Seinfeld, doesn't necessarily think that much will change.
No, I think everything will be pretty close to the same as what it is.
Why is that?
I think people think big changes, big things cause big change. They sometimes do and they sometimes don't. We're not, humans are not good prognosticators. We're not good predictors of things. We're good worriers. We're good, we really know how to anticipate and get anxious. We're great at that. We are not great at really seeing what's coming.
Jerry Seinfeld being modest about how far filmmakers can look into the future. He was speaking to Tom Brooke. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. And just a word that coming up on the programme, Donald Trump wants the former Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard to be his new Director of National Intelligence. We'll assess her chances of winning approval for the nomination from the Senate.
I think it could be a very heavy lift because, you know, I don't think she has any kind of natural constituency in the Senate. But then on top of that, I just think there's going to be serious questions about, you know, her stances on Russia for someone who's going to be seeing a lot of intelligence that we collect on Russia.
More on Tulsi Gabbard's chances of becoming Director of National Intelligence in about 20 minutes. Now, a well-known Iranian human rights activist has killed himself in protest at what he called the dictatorship of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Kianush Sanjari had posted on social media to say that he would take his own life if four political prisoners were not released by yesterday evening local time. Hours later, his death was confirmed by fellow activists. Joining me in the NewsHour studio is the correspondent with the BBC Persian Service, Jia Gol. Jia, tell me first of all who Kianush Sanjari was.
He was a well-known Iranian activist and advocate for human rights and democracy. Also, he was a journalist. He worked for Voice of America, Persian Service, for a few years. And he has been very outspoken, despite, obviously, he moved back to Iran. And he has been, since then, despite arrest, intimidation, and numerous time to be detained, he never stopped criticizing the supreme leader of Iran and the autocracy. And always he said he's wishing for a democratic Iran. And even moments before he committed suicide, he said he wished to wake up one day, the Iranian, overcome the slavery. He called the current government, the current regime in the country, compared to a slavery. And also a few years earlier, he said, this life owe me a homeland. A homeland, just I want, like a simple person, to live. And I think his story is the story of many Iranian who are fighting what's going on in the country and fighting for freedom.
And what were the circumstances of his death? I mean, these four political prisoners he was talking about, we may not have time for you to go through all of them, but what was it about them that he particularly wanted to draw attention to?
I think more it was a symbolic symbolic move by him. Those political prisoners, all of them has been arrested in the past few years after the uprising in Iran. Two of them are women. One of them is the mother of one of those victims, 16 years old, Nika Shakarami, who was killed by security forces during the protest. His mother, because of the protest, because speaking up, she has been arrested in the last few months. And I think it was more of a desperation. I think he was trying to attract attention to the condition of those political prisoners inside Iran. That's why he committed suicide. Before that, many Iranian well-known activists inside and outside Iran, because he was talking about this in the past 24 hours before he committed suicide, they tried to persuade him to stop to do that, but unfortunately they failed, and he kept his word and he committed suicide.
You mentioned that he had worked abroad. I think he'd been granted asylum abroad as well, hadn't he? Why did he return? Because he must have known that, I mean, my goodness me, it wasn't going to be easy for him.
I think so. See, despite all of the danger, he worked for Voice of America. He was in Norway and United States of America. He decided to go back because his mother was sick. He couldn't stay away. And he went back. He was arrested, spent 2 years in prison. Months of he was in a solitary confinement. Later he described it was a white torture, because for months when you are in solitary confinement, you have no idea where you are. And also he was insulted, and he heard other prisoners also being insulted. I don't think he ever overcome that. He said after on medical condition, he was grounded, he was released, but he was checked in psychiatric hospital. The trauma, the PTSD, never left him. But also, I don't think it is just simple as about a psychological issue with him. I think what is happening in Iran, as a journalist, as an activist, he didn't have a job. The government fired him. Possible. It was impossible for him to continue. And also the situation in the country after numbers of people, scores of people were killed in the uprising 2 years ago. The situation is getting worse and worse. And unfortunately, by this action, he tried to make a statement.
Just very briefly, GR, do you get a sense of how news of his death has been received in Iran?
I think since yesterday, it's been devastating for so many people, even for us in BBC Persian as a journalist who knew him. He was on our television and our network numbers of time inside Iran, talking about human rights, freedom of expression, and also criticizing the regime from inside. We saw him as a brave man who fought for human rights, and it was devastating for so many people inside and outside the country.
Gia Gol, correspondent with the BBC Persian Service, thank you very much. We've been spending a lot of time this week hearing from Azerbaijan, host of the annual UN climate talks, COP29 as they're known. We haven't heard much, though, about life inside Azerbaijan, which the human rights advocacy groups have long criticised as an authoritarian regime. Indeed, the Washington-based institution Freedom House gives Azerbaijan a score of precisely 0 out of 40, 0, for its political rights. Gubad Ibadoglu is an economist, an academic, and a critic of the government and its environmental record. He was a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. But last year, he was detained when he returned to Azerbaijan to visit his sick mother. Now, under house arrest in the capital, Baku, he told me what led to the day his life was turned upside down.
I have continued to actively participate in the Azerbaijani social and the political life. And also, I share my analysis of corruption in Azerbaijan in the variety of forums, including the Facebook and my independent YouTube channel. And in June 2023, when I was traveling with my wife to visit my sick mother in my home country, we were violently ambushed. And 2 weeks prior to my detention, I announced it on the Facebook that the group would accept donation and seek access to the foreign assets confiscated from the corrupt Azerbaijani oligarch to support our efforts.
Gubad, you said in July last year, you and your wife were violently ambushed. What happened?
I and my wife together return to home. And then I was driving and suddenly 5-6 vehicles surrounded us, approximately 20 people playing close in the mask emerged from the vehicles and ordered us to exit our vehicle, violently dragging my wife from the car. My wife attempted to free herself from the masked men, and they punched her face, also beat her. She injured from her head. She's still under the control of the medical doctors in the Sweden. Now she's seriously ill in the Sweden. I am seriously ill in the Azerbaijan. We cannot reunite it. And after the 7-8 hours, my wife was eventually released. I was detained in the police custody without the medication, despite I am the diabetic 2-type. At the same time, I have the very, very high blood pressure. I have the very risky illness in my heart. It required the surgery. I want to say that in Azerbaijan, medical system is under strict control by the Minister of the Internal Affairs and the State Security Service. That's why I don't trust the local doctors. And next day, I transferred from the police custody to the pretrial detention center in Baku. And during my stay, I had uneven access to my medicine, as well as drinking water and proper food. It was very, very difficult time in my life during the 274 days in the cell. And on 22 April this year, I was transferred to the house arrest. Currently, I am, in fact, in the house arrest. And at the same time, I am under the travel ban. Still two serious charges.
On that, I know that the authorities had been investigating what they said was your links with the controversial Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who's just died. Just on those issues, in terms of the money that was seized from an old office of yours and also the links with Gulen, what have you got to say about those two things?
They didn't present any evidence about my connection with Fethullah Gulen. They accused me in my computer. They find the religious extremist material, including the publication of Gulen's. I am not a religious person. I didn't have any connection with the Gulen's education system. They claim that I counterfeited US dollar in Azerbaijan, not pounds, despite I live in the London. I am facing up to 17 years in prison, if convicted.
Gubad, you're facing quite serious charges. From what you've said, you've been through an ordeal. You're unwell. You are also talking in quite strong language about, I mean, in your words, corrupt Azerbaijan oligarchs. Why are you talking to me now? Why are you speaking out from house arrest?
Still, I am at the risk to be re-imprisoned in Azerbaijan. There is no fair legal system in Azerbaijan. And this is the mostly political decision made by the high level in Azerbaijan. They want to show that if somebody against us, we are able to arrest even the professor of the London School of Economics. It's very important for the authoritarian governance to show others, please take your lesson from the arrest of, for example, the Gubadi Badoglu and others, because I am now one of the 319 political prisoners in Azerbaijan. I'm not alone. A lot of the journalists behind bar in Azerbaijan, and they try to silence the critics against the Azerbaijan government.
And that was Gubad Ibadoglu speaking to me from house arrest in Baku. We did request an interview with the Azerbaijani government. They couldn't put anybody up, but they have just given us a statement through the Azerbaijan embassy in London. Part of it reads, "We strongly reject allegations about political prisoners in Azerbaijan. All legal proceedings in the country, including those related to financial matters, are based on specific violations of existing laws and regulations of the Republic of Azerbaijan." For people unfamiliar with this, it might be tempting to present every legal case as political Unfortunately, these types of allegations are most unhelpful and disruptive for international relations. This is the BBC World Service. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. Earlier this week, Russia's lower house of parliament passed a law that would ban what it calls propaganda advocating a child-free lifestyle. The upper house is expected to approve the legislation shortly. It's part of a broader effort by the Kremlin to reverse falling birth rates. Estimates vary widely, but one study by academics in Moscow suggests that the country's population could fall by half by the end of the century, down to just 67 million. Crassy Twig from BBC Monitoring reports now on the Kremlin's ideas for future-proofing the nation.
The country's population is shrinking fast and its leaders are alarmed. Russia's fertility rate is similar to European countries, but its death rate is much higher. And there's a number of recent factors that have accelerated the population decline, including the war in Ukraine. Francis Carr is one of BBC Monitoring's Russia experts.
The upper estimate given by US intelligence is that 200,000 Russian men have been killed fighting in Ukraine. But there are also other consequences. Russian men are simply not at home to procreate. In the autumn of 2022, when the Russian authorities declared their so-called partial mobilization, there was a huge number of people leaving the country. And one recent investigation found that around 650,000 people had still not gone back.
Russia is now pretty much functioning as a war economy. Feeding the war machine and encouraging new life seem like contradictory objectives. The dilemma how to pursue both has spawned a myriad of proposals.
Some of the measures have already been in place for several years. The most well-known one in Russia is the lump sum payment for new mothers. This was launched in 2007, originally for second children. But in 2020, this was also extended to the first child.
But despite these financial incentives, Russian data suggests Russians are not in a hurry to have more children. So the carrot alone is not enough.
Veronika Malinboim is another Russia watcher from our team in Tbilisi.
Various different officials are almost trying to compete in proposing the sort of more outlandish measures. Some proposing the introduction of childlessness tax. Some propose banning microsmall for one-bedroom apartments. Some say it would be good to have people move from cities to villages, because then they are bound to have more children.
The role of women is central to this push for bigger families. Access to abortion in Russia is in line with many Western countries, but the situation is changing. Private clinics seem to have become a testing ground for limiting access to abortion, and there are further measures seen as another nail in the coffin of freedom of expression.
There is also a ban on propaganda of abortions and incitement to abortions in several regions. Because it's such a vague definition, anything could fall under it. The most worrying law that is currently in the working is the ban on the propaganda of a child-free lifestyle.
If the demographic crisis continues, what would the consequences be? Francis Carr again.
Putin really likes to talk up the idea of a Russia that has been raised from its knees after the collapse of the Soviet Union, a country that is now standing up for itself on the international stage, and if Russia's current population trajectory continues, there's no chance that Russia will have the resources, the weight, the influence to bring this vision of the future to reality.
Francis Sky ending that report by Crassy Twig. Now, back to our top story, the latest and perhaps most eye-catching picks on the incoming US President Donald Trump for some of the top jobs in his government. We heard about Matt Gaetz earlier, his choice for Attorney General, which has aroused a certain amount of controversy. Another person who's prompted a fair amount of comment is the woman who he wants to be Director of National Intelligence, overseeing the country's many security agencies and secret services, Tulsi Gabbard. Rebecca Beitsch is the National Security Reporter for The Hill. She told us more.
This is a really important position. So not only are you leading one intelligence agency, this is the intelligence agency that coordinates among all 18 of the U.S. intelligence agencies. And so not only are they, you know, receiving all this intel and monitoring everything, but they're also packaging it all together for the president's daily brief. So these are the people that advise the president on the intelligence that's being collected and help craft foreign policy responses and national security decisions. So it's a major, major role.
Now, as for Tulsi Gabbard, she has been on quite a journey. We may not have time for you to take us through all of its twists, but tell us about this person who began as and until relatively recently, was a Democrat.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a four-time Democratic congresswoman. In 2020, she ran in the presidential primaries against Biden. And, you know, she was always like a little bit of a Democratic wild card, but she really has undergone a massive political transformation. I mean, this was someone who did endorse Bernie Sanders in 2016, and then, you know, this year helped Trump with debate prep. So she formally left the Democratic Party in 2022, and then this was the first year that she's officially become a Republican.
And you, as you were saying, I mean, you know, when she was a Democratic candidate, at least candidate for the nomination for the presidency, she took positions very critical of Donald Trump over, for example, the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the very powerful Iranian head of the Revolutionary Guard, him putting out of the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. Tell me about some of the other positions that she has taken in recent years when it comes to foreign policy.
Well, so one kind of strain where she is aligned with Trump is she has expressed a lot of anti-interventionist foreign policy views. You know, her foreign policy stances that are getting the most attention right now, especially as she's being nominated for this key intelligence role, it's just the way that she's, you know, floated a lot of pro-Russian narratives in recent years. And that includes like false claims that Ukraine was developing biological weapons. In 2022, she accused Biden of, you know, failing to address Russia's, quote, legitimate security concerns about Ukraine becoming a NATO member. And so just given some of those views, you've seen her be attacked from like both sides of the aisle, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton, for just kind of forwarding these pro-Russia narratives.
And given that, do you think, I mean, we have heard it earlier in the program from about Matt Gaetz, the possibility that he may have a bit of a bumpy ride in his Senate confirmation hearing. But how far do you think the same might be true for Tulsi Gabbard?
I think it could be a very heavy lift because, you know, I don't think she, you know, has any kind of natural constituency in the Senate. Think any Democrats are going to support her given the fact that she's left the party. And, you know, she's kind of a newcomer when it comes to, you know, aligning herself with Republicans. But then on top of that, I just think there's going to be serious questions about, you know, her stances on Russia for someone who's going to be seeing a lot of intelligence that we collect on Russia. And we didn't touch on this yet, but, you know, she also in 2017 met with Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. I imagine that that is going to be something that comes up a lot during this confirmation process as well.
Rebecca Beich from The Hill. That's it from NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here, thanks for listening.